Good morning, everyone. Hi. Okay. Today I'm going to talk about labor market and gender inequalities. I think there will be interesting lectures after me. So what I will present are some just general overviews, but also some insights and thoughts I have on the topic. I'm going to focus this morning on paid work. As you've learned in your previous from your previous instructors, that work has a much broader meaning than what takes place in the labor market. You have the unpaid work. But what I'm going to do is just focus on paid work for now. Let me just put the context in which I'm going to discuss labor markets and the gender dimensions. First of all, there exists, as we know, and as you know, global rules that tend to determine the direction of labor market processes. Okay. And also, with those, you know, sort of those global rules and country-specific and region-specific conditions, you have economic restructuring that's continuing in developing countries as well as in developed countries. One of the things I want to highlight is that these rules, as well as the process of economic restructuring, has led to a great deal of unevenness and inequalities. I think now with the financial crisis that has beset countries both in the developing and developed world, we know that you have tensions and contradictions arising from that. Okay. Now, I'd like to discuss broadly some of what I think are the main factors, both at the macro as well as micro level, that affected the labor market trends we observe in the last 40 years. At the micro level, there's been a great deal of firm restructuring. You have technological change, you have dramatic growth in information technology and communication, okay, leading to a lot of changes at the firm and business organization level in terms of coming up with cost saving and lean manufacturing and device, and that include labor cost saving. Okay, that has led to a lot of employment shifts. In many parts, in many sectors, you have downsizing, so you essentially have only a small core regular workforce, and then you have a much broader flexible labor force. You also have the development of what you call the supply chain, global chain, okay? Linking work processes that take place in developing countries as well as in developed countries. You have outsourcing and subcontracting. You have mergers and acquisition. Okay, just, for example, you have the offshoring. You have also, like Whirlpool, Procter & Gamble, General Motors in the United States. You have also supply chains. Walmart is a very good example of that. Okay, these are some of the advertisements to promote supply chain. Okay. Okay. Accompanying these trends at the firm level are macroeconomic policies that have promoted labor market deregulation. Okay. So you have the removal of minimum wages, deunionization, erosion of worker rights, okay, all happening amidst structural adjustment program and trade liberalization policies. Okay. Yeah. There's been also a lot of talk about labor flexibility, and that's a good thing in the midst of globalization. Okay. The argument has been that there's a need to adapt for firms to adapt rapidly to changing market conditions, especially growing competitiveness. Okay. There's also the interest in terms of, from the point of view of labor, the argument is made that, well, labor now is very flexible. You don't have to be loyal to any one firm. You can move whoever gives you the better contract. Okay. So there's avoidance of attachment of firms also to labor. Firms don't have to be loyal to their employees. Okay. And flexibility allows firms to adjust wages, adjust their labor force, depending on the market conditions. Okay. So the neoliberal policies have promoted the notion of labor flexibility being a good thing in an era of globalization and increasing competitiveness. And of course, we have to add the most recent in the factor of financial crisis. You have global financial crisis, which has led to economic to layoffs, decline in trade. You have also contraction of formal market economies, okay, growing budget deficits, and fiscal cuts, which means that if employment in the formal sector, and that's the big round circle there, decreases, okay, during periods of economic downturn, you have the growth of other sectors of the economy. The informal sector, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the reproductive care economy. Okay, that includes all and subsistence production. Okay. Okay. Now, let me go over briefly on the recent employment trends in the developing countries. I think the next speaker, Naoko, is going to talk more about the conditions of work around the world. But just general trends here that I'd like to highlight. First of all, in the last 30, 40 years, there has been increasing employment of women in many parts of the world, most parts of the world. You see rising labor force participation. Okay. There is, in particular, increase in employment in certain sectors in the last 30, 40 years, especially in the export-oriented industries, such as textiles and garments. You have, for example, in the 70s and 80s to the early 90s, the creation of export processing zones, okay, sort of to take advantage of the fact that you have this supply of even cheaper labor, that is women's labor, that you can tap on, okay. Also, you have the growth, as we know, of the service sector, both in the developed and the developing countries. You have sales, tourism, entertainment, domestic service. We'll talk a little bit about the care economy in a little while. Okay. Also, you have growing migration of labor. Okay. Part of it has got to do with the inability of developing countries to create jobs for their workforce. I come from a country which has provided a lot of migrant workers throughout the world. That's the Philippines, okay? And there's also, of course, the great difference between earnings in the developed world, developed countries, and the developing countries, okay? And therefore, you attract even skilled workers like teachers or college-educated women workers in the Philippines to work as nannies and domestic workers, say, in Hong Kong or in Europe. On the recipient country side, you have the growing care economy needs. Okay, increased demand for women workers as caregivers, whether they be nurses, babysitters, or caregivers, assistants in nursing homes, and even in private homes, as well as care for the sick. We also observe persistence of wage gaps. Okay, several studies done by Stephanie Seguini, for example, and Gunzeli Beric and others have examined the growth of South Korea and Taiwan on the basis of gender wage gaps. Okay? You have also persistence of occupational segregation. And all of this is taking place in the developing countries, which is unlike the developed countries, where there are no safety nets, no unemployment compensation scheme, or very little in unemployment compensation scheme, and limited or absence of any trade-related assistance programs. So all these changes or shifts are taking place in the absence of these protection schemes. Okay. What I'm going to talk about are two important trends in the labor market. One is the growing informalization of employment, and the other is the role of women in labor markets, particularly in the informal sector. And then I will end with some thoughts on research, what kind of research and what are the gaps in our knowledge, as well as policy. Result of the factors that I mentioned earlier has led to the rising informalization of jobs. Okay. Informal employment, and I don't know whether Nyoko is going to talk about this in her presentation, but it's roughly estimated to be 50 to 67% of all non-agricultural employment in the developing world. Okay. And it is particularly an important source of livelihood for women. Okay, some of the estimates of the size of the informal sector in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, shows that 84% of non-agricultural employment of women non-agricultural informal workers are women. And to a lesser extent, but still a very substantial part of the non-agricultural workforce, being women, is true for Latin American region. Okay. Now, this data is taken from the 2005 UNIFEM study on progress on world's women, which shows self-employment as a percentage of non-agricultural informal employment and wage employment as a percentage of non-agricultural informal employment. This table just shows that there are a great deal of variation. And I'll also talk about some of the limitations of our knowledge, particularly in terms of data collection in the informal sector. So you have to keep that caveat in mind when you look at these numbers. But nonetheless, the numbers reveal the importance of the informal sector for employment. Okay. Now, before I continue, I just want to make a clear distinction between the term informal economy, that's now being more generally used rather than just informal sector, and the so-called black market economy. Underground economy. Okay, the ILO makes a very clear distinction between the two, even though there might be areas of overlap. Okay, informal economy is legal for the most part. They are dealing with production and employment of goods and services that are legal, but the arrangement, the work arrangement, is either semi-legal or illegal. Illegal in the sense, for example, that they may not follow any kind of labor code in the country or any kind of minimum wage, if ever that's enforced, if that's part of the labor code in the country. Okay? Criminal economy, on the other, deal with goods and services that are illegal. So you have to separate between the output and the work arrangement or labor contract. Then I also want to talk about informalized employment as a term and the informal sector jobs or work. Okay, you can have informalized employment in the formal sector. Okay, you have a lot of temporary or casual workers in firms that have become lean, so to speak, meaning to say you have a core small group of regular stable job workforce, and then you have a broader or larger flexible, casual, contracted, or temporary workers. Okay, and that's true both in the developed countries, industrialized countries, as well as in the developing countries. Okay, jobs in the informal sector, on the other hand, means that, I mean, Naoko can talk more probably about the definition of them. There's a lot of this, you know, discussion on what defines the informal sector. And different studies may use the define the term differently. But the jobs in the informal sector, for the most part, involve self-employed on account in informal enterprises. And you can hire also workers, like you can run a small business or a micro enterprise. And or you could be a wage employer, like agriculture workers who are seasonal workers, or subcontracting or piece rate workers. Okay. Now, before I go into the other characteristics of the informal sector, I just want to highlight the sort of ongoing debate at the theoretical level on how to view this informalization of employment. There are people or economists such as William Maloney of the World Bank, okay, and Hernando de Soto and others who argue that this is a very positive thing. Okay, labor is able to adapt rapidly. You don't have this rigidity of labor markets which neoclassical economists don't like. Okay. You don't have any more the regulation aspect that constrains labor markets from reaching equilibrium wages. Okay? You have great labor market flexibility, so it's good for the employer. And they will also argue it's good for the employee or the worker. You have flexible jobs. Talk about home-based work, for example. Well, now you can work at home. You can do both your paid work and unpaid work. You are able to combine it. Okay. There are other interpretations, however, of what's going on in the labor market in terms of the trends that we have just discussed. Okay. Job insecurity leads to economic insecurity. It also has brought about or reinforce the trends in inequality. In the industrialized countries like the United States, it's very clear there's a big gap between skilled workers and unskilled workers. It's a threat to basic living standards. If you have precarious jobs or jobs that do not provide you with any rights or benefits, you're not likely to meet your living standard. I'll talk this afternoon on the notion of vulnerability. Okay. And from a political economy standpoint, one has to see labor market trends as part of the overall sort of continuous tension between capital and labor. That this labor market flexibility is really a part of the weakening of the bargaining power of labor. And therefore, there's a need for social protection, need for social contracts, need for protection of workers' rights. Okay. Talking about contracts, well, there, as Lourdes Beneria once says, there are two types of contracts now. There's the old, so-called old employment contract, and there's now the new employment contract. In the old contract, you have internal labor markets. In fact, you can have promotion. You can rise up from the ranks to being the managerial supervisory position. You have more or less stable working conditions. Unionized labor, say, for example, labor loyalty to the firm, and the firm, to some extent, needs to meet the needs, see the need to meet the workers' needs. You provide so-called fringe benefits. They're not really fringe, but they're considered fringe benefits in that literature. But the new contract that begin that to dominate the result of this informalization of employment meant individualization of labor contracts. I'm going to use my university as an example. Okay, I'm from American University, and each contract with faculty or staff is individualized. Okay, can't ask about what your wages and salaries are. It's a no-no. Okay, new contract also means less stable employment. A lot now more on so-called consultancy jobs. Okay, new contract involves contingent work. I'm a temp, or I'm part-time work. There are reduction of benefits, and that has led to economic insecurity. Here are some photos of that were taken in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, where about, 7 years ago, I, together with several students, as well as Lourdes Beneria and researchers in different countries, gathered, collected data on the urban informal sector. This is in Santa Cruz. Oops. And this is in El Alto. So even the foreign exchange dealer is in the informal economy. Okay. If you're riding the shuttle bus, we had an informal contract being offered to you in terms of exchange of currencies. Informal sector employment is very heterogeneous. Okay, sometimes it's treated like a black box, like the household model, in the sense that you know you don't know anything about it. Just talk about it, sort of as if it's uniform, and it's not. There's very interesting diversities and range of jobs that takes place in the informal economy. One that's been observed, for example, by several researchers. It was, for example, mentioned in UNIFEM, in the ILO reports, and by WIGO, Marty Chen and others, and those who have done work on the informal sector, is that you have now a bipolarization overall of these trends in the informal economy. On one hand, you do have some dynamic informal sector activities, and that's what Hernando de Soto, William Maloney are referring to. Yes, look at this informal sector. It's vibrant, it's dynamic. This really shows how, you know, democracy, economic democracy, and so forth stands for. You have the use of capital and skills to raise productivity and earnings in the absence of any kind of restrictions and rigidities of labor markets, and so forth and so on. But it's also important that you have precarious jobs in the informal sector. You have street vendors. You have beggars. You have panhandlers. That's what we found in the Philippines. Okay, that require little skills and capital, prone to excessive competition, and subject to high income variability. One day you earn $20, the next day you earn nothing. Maybe on Sunday I will earn $40. It's unpredictable. I borrowed this slide from the report of UNIFEM in 2005, published by, I think it's, the authors were Marty Chen, Joan Vanek, and James Hines, which show that there's also a gender segmentation, gender-based segmentation in the informal employment, where men tend to be the employers of more skilled-based enterprises that require capital, like mechanics and repair shops, retailing, trades. And then you have at the very bottom the so-called industrial outworkers or home-based workers, home workers. Okay, and of course, if your earnings, as you go down that hierarchy, not only decline, but also becomes highly uncertain or variable, then you have very high poverty risk as well. So the term working poor is not doesn't only apply to America, because there are many several books on working poor in America, but it certainly applies to many in the developing countries. Okay, let me talk now about the women in the informal economy. Okay, study after study on empirical studies on informal economy shows women to be highly concentrated in certain activities in the informal economy, and that women and that workers in the informal economy tend to be predominantly women. Okay. Now, it's very interesting also that there's an debate going on here. Is the informal sector job a matter of choice? And some neoclassical economists, yes. Women choose to work in those low-earning jobs. It's an occupational choice. It's a matter of choice because then they could have flexible labor time. They can have labor fluid between paid and unpaid work. They can work at home. Okay, they give up higher earnings and benefits for flexibility. Okay, but is that story really true? Well, there have been very good studies on home-based work. Now we have better documentation and increasing number of empirical research on home-based work, which are predominantly women, okay? And one of the interesting characteristics of home-based work is that there's the link, interlinkage between the production sector and the reproductive sector. Okay? Women are able to combine paid and unpaid work. Okay, they earn as well as able to meet their domestic care responsibilities. On the other hand, they're very vulnerable both to the nature of the employment, their own piece rate. They are isolated for the most part from other workers because they tend to work at home unless they are organized, okay? And also because of their gender roles, okay? They work very long hours, and I'll talk about that later on. The hours are long, and their intensity of work is very high. They can do two things at the same time. Now, when you do two things at the same time, it's good to do it maybe for 20 minutes while you're on the phone and you're typing, but if you do it for 2 hours being on the phone and working on your computer, you either have tension, stress, and certainly even your output is going to decline. Okay. Now, I do hope that some of you would embark on doing gendered research in the informal economy. But there are challenges involved. Data availability. I think now we are improving the data collection. I think there are really efforts both at the global level as well as at each country, at the country level, to improve data collection. But still, there are underestimations of certain types of activities, and there's certainly room for improvement. And in other countries, they just don't collect data on the informal economy. When you talk about the labor force, it's really the formal labor force. But they also try to capture, to some extent, unpaid agriculture workers as well as subsistence production. That has been included now in most labor force surveys. But home-based work and other types, precarious types of employment, are still not adequately captured by existing data. Another challenge in looking at the informal economy from a gendered perspective, you cannot just look at the informal employment as a productive activity independent of the reproductive activity. Especially in the case of home-based work, you have to treat the household both as a unit of consumption and production. to look, for example, at microenterprise and its success, or whether women in microenterprise borrow credit or not, just looking at the product enterprise needs, I think misses a large part of the story. That women both wear the hat of being an entrepreneur in running a microenterprise, and at the same time, also trying to make ends meet in their homes. So credit can be used for production need, but also for consumption need. Okay. There's also multi-job dimensions of workers. A lot of these informal workers, because of the informal character and precarious nature of some of their jobs, work several jobs at the same time. This morning I'm going to sell food. Later in the afternoon I'm going to do some piece rate work and so forth. So they are engaged in multiple jobs. And how do you capture that? Okay. There's also variability in earnings. So saying I earn $300 a month on average, assumes that you earn it evenly throughout that period, and it may not be the case. Okay? You have also unpaid workers in enterprises. We also found out in our study that certain micro-enterprises are really joint enterprise. It's both the husband and the wife, although the wife may likely run and spend more time in the enterprise, but who makes the decision on the enterprise may be the husband. Okay. Also have to look at the decision making on informal employment or enterprise, not under certainty, but under risk and uncertainty. If you think that you're going to not have the same kind of sales and revenue next month, how is it going to affect your decision now in your production process? Okay. And of course, there's also these dynamic relations between the formal and informal sector. Some of the informal enterprise are really part of the global supply chain. So you cannot see it only separate from what the conditions that happen in the market You cannot see it separate from the formal economy condition, the macroeconomic conditions. There are direct linkages. How am I doing with time? Okay, I probably will finish early, so I'll have more. Okay. In terms of policy and action, I want to talk about the macroeconomic and labor policies, just in again, very broad sense, and I hope we'll have more discussion in it. We really need not just for growth-oriented policy, but sustainable economic growth and development. We need to talk about, there's really need for governments to think carefully about employment policies, not as as a central feature of their agenda, not as an ad hoc, okay, let's talk about trade, let's talk about monetary, let's talk about finance. Oh, and by the way, let's look at some labor policies here. Cannot be that. We have to change the priorities or push governments to think about the priorities that they have to that they need to work on. Okay, employment policy promoting decent jobs, and I think Anayoko might spend more time on what decent work mean. We also need to talk about, as part of labor policies addressing care work. And gendered labor policy has to take both paid and unpaid work as very much linked. In Europe, for example, like in Sweden, you have so-called policies that enable men and women to balance both the demands for their time, care work, and paid work. U.S., United States, still lagging behind for that. They don't even have anything by way of child care bill, child care support or child care subsidy bill. So need to think about that from an engendered perspective. It's important to see paid work in the context of its link with the reproductive care economy. Otherwise, you get again into the same notion that work is full-time breadwinner work. that you don't need to think about what goes on in terms of care economy. And then we need to think also about workers' rights and labor standards. The protection of workers' rights in the midst of all this financial crisis is very important. And of course, during financial crisis, okay, you have massive layoffs, which makes also workers more vulnerable. And you see that also, for example, in negotiations, in the closing or the negotiation of the so-called arranged bankruptcy of the automobile industry in the United States. You have, for example, some participation of the labor unions in the automobile industry. But you get to see them making concessions because of the crisis. But it's important to know what to negotiate and what is fundamental and not subject to negotiation. Okay? The right to organize is one of them. Okay? Now, there have been another area of debate and growing interest, at least until the financial crisis hit and has taken a lot of the media attention as well as economists' attention, is the core labor standards. Okay, labor standards. Do you impose labor standards or not? Do you uphold labor standards or not? Okay. Now, there are core labor standards, and there are some what you call extended labor standards. At the core, if you look at the ILO Declaration on Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work in June 1998, it includes right to collective bargaining, protection of children from hazardous form of labor, and elimination of discrimination at work, as well as freedom of association. Now, some of the extended labor standards include hours of work coverage, minimum age, conditions at work, and basic needs or living wage. Okay. Finally, okay, given the growing economic insecurity, okay, worldwide, there's now a lot of talk and focus on the role of social protection and social policies. The social protection, social policies need to take into account not just the workers in the formal market, more formal economy, but also in the informal sector. It needs to be integrated into any poverty alleviation program, as well as I will call vulnerability reduction program, because workers can be vulnerable, but not necessarily income poor. Many of the home-based workers, for example, in some studies, do not fall, their earnings do not fall under below the poverty line. So they're technically not poor, income poor, but they are very vulnerable. We need to talk about health insurance schemes, adjustment assistance program, okay? Any kind of fiscal stimulus has to take this into account and provide support for this. At the end of the day, social protection involves distribution. And I think that's one of the things that we need, you know, in looking at social protection, okay, by necessity, it involves some redistributive policies, whether it be fiscal, whether it be labor, whether it be other types of economic policies. Thank you.
Thank you very much for such interesting presentation. And I have here two questions. I have mentioned in your presentation that firms avoid to attach labor when they are, and that means labor flexibility. But you see, on the other hand, we all know that whenever labor is not attached to the firms, it reduces efficiency of the work. And we all know at the same time success of Japanese economy was in great extent due to the their style of management that in, that means that they are hiring workers for life for all their lifelong and are ensuring social protection and everything they need. And whenever the firms are not attaching their labors firmly, does not that mean that they behave in such ways with only unskilled labor, not with the skilled one, you see? So in this case, maybe the gender is more vividly seen in this respect, in this regard, you see. And the second question, you have mentioned here informal sector and rapid increase of this informal sector and women labor that is used in this sector. What are the causes of increasing of these informal sectors? I have some my considerations on this regard, but I'm interested in your opinion. On the other hand, you see, I have such experience. I am from former Soviet Republic, it's Georgia, and we have a huge volume of informal sector in our economy, but due to the simplification of business registers and improvement of business environment, it was significantly decreased. But that does not mean that rights of workers, especially women's rights, are protected in private sectors, especially in small and medium enterprises, you see. Only huge private companies and state companies are protecting the rights. Sometimes we have the case of violations of workers. For instance, one of my friends was hired by a U.S. company. It was headed by U.S. Country citizens. And he went to court and win the case, by the way. So increase of formal sector and establishing labor code principles and core objectives and core standards, that does not mean automatically that these standards will be realized in the life. So what is your suggestion in this case and what can be done? To my opinion, it should be state who should provide social protection.
Can you repeat the last statement you have? I didn't get it.
Which one, excuse me?
It is the role of who? The state? Is
I think my opinion is it should be state who should protect, because private companies, especially small ones, small and medium ones, aren't because it's against their profit rising, you see, and they have no reason and no stimulus to protect their right because it's expensive and it's reduced their profit, and they are profit oriented, all of them. You see? Okay, thank you.
I think we should probably take a number of questions. Yes.
Yes. Just making sure. I have a comment followed by a question. Picking up from your presentation that there's also a conceptual tension with the role in terms of what the role of the informal economy is. And I wanted you to address the conceptual tension and how I'm seeing it is that the informal sector, in a sense, has responded to the weaknesses of the formal sector, particularly under neoliberalism. But at the same time, the informal sector has its own set of weaknesses because of how insecure and how precarious the sector is for employment of both men and women. But at the same time, if we look at some of the literature from the World Bank and the IMF, there's the idea that the informal sector needs to be eliminated. Mm-hmm. You know, and that they're not in the tax threshold and so on and so forth. They're far more, the impression that I get is that they're far more concerned that the informal sector is not in the tax threshold, rather than the fact that it provides precarious unemployment and that we have people who are on the margins and whose rights are not being protected and it's not decent work. I don't get the impression that they are concerned about those aspects of the informal sector. Mm-hmm. So And at this, in addition to that, I have a problem with the getting rid of the informal sector, mm-hmm. because there are aspects of the informal sector that I think are actually quite ingenious. Mm-hmm. And let me point to an example from Jamaica. Mm-hmm. If you, every 2 or 2 years, you have to get your car has to be proven roadworthy. So you get what is called a certificate of fitness. And you carry your car to the examination depot, and it is tested, you know, to see if it is still roadworthy. Mm-hmm. And you get a certificate of fitness, and you cannot keep your car on the road in Jamaica without that certificate of fitness. Now, if you're going to get your certificate of fitness renewed, it can take you 3 hours because the lines are long.
The bureaucracy
of it, right? I am one of those persons, and I'm not ashamed to say that I pay a space holder. Because when I go there, I don't have 3 hours to wait. I have to go back to work. I just don't have the 3 hours. So there's somebody there who calls himself a space holder, and you pay him a certain amount of money for every half hour that he's holding that space for you. And he calls you on his phone to say, I'm about half an hour before your turn. So you come back, you go there, he stands in the line, he occupies your space. When you're almost ready to go up into the line now, you go back, pay him your money, and then it is your turn 15 minutes later. Wonderful. It works brilliantly. Now, why am I going to get rid of that man? That is part of the informal sector. He's interacting with the formal, with formal employment. But it is not working. Yeah. Right? So, and that is just one occupation that he created. There are many others that have been created, right? So there's those kinds of ingenious things that I think, mm-hmm. while it's an indication of what is not working in the formal sector, but at the same time, he's harming no one. And he has created employment for himself, right? So how then, why do we want to get rid of that kind of ingenious employment, so to speak? The other part that I was hoping that you'd address, and maybe you could address it now, is the other aspects of the precarious occupations in the informal sector that I find has popped up with neoliberalism, and it is what I guess you could call some kind of a distorted globalization of the body, of the female body in particular. So you have things like prostitution more prevalent than before. We have things like trafficking, mm-hmm. you know. We have things like the quasi-massage parlors, you know. So these are, I think, I was hoping that you would be able to address these as aspects of what is happening in the informal sector that I find, from a non-economic mind, is part of the weakness of this neoliberal model. And I would like to know, what is it about the neoliberal model that is creating these kinds of occupations that do threaten the decent work agenda? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Sergio, for the interesting insights. Well, one quick question. I don't know if I missed something. Do you have current data on the structure of unemployment or changing pattern of unemployment linked to the current financial crisis by gender? Linked to the financial crisis. Can we? Is it possible to substantiate, you know, some of these notions that women, you know, get laid off faster because of lower skills? Placed on the lower rungs of career ladders. I think that would be, you know, a great insight into linking this presentation to the current crisis. Well, secondly, talking about the labor standards and, taking care of the interest of women in the formal and informal sector. I just finished a quick study in my country looking at the presence and the implementation of gender-aware policies in the private and public sector. And interestingly, we found that there are more gender aware, not policies per se, but practices, you know, not necessarily policies in place, but practices that have been ingrained into the system in the private sector. And I mean, this has been a very surprising finding for most people that have seen the results, the data. And we're trying to probe further to find out why this would be so. But one of the suggestions is that of relative productivity of women and men in the private sector. I mean, there's a query on that. Is there any evidence to show whether women are more efficient, more productive in the private sector than men? And the reverse in the public sector. I don't know if there are any studies that, you know, that could point to that, or why the private sector will be more responsive to maintaining decent work environment for women. And we also found that although the workplace crèches are very few, you know, just coming up, but most of the ones that are available are linked to private sector spaces rather than public employment spaces. And most of them are actually, well, put in place by women's groups through, you know, I mean, as a result of social mobilization, you know, rather than deliberate government policies to have them. You know, these are interesting insights, but then it points to the fact that the responsiveness of state to these needs are really quite low, and that it is as a result of activism that these changes are taking place rather than responsiveness of government policy. And it points to the need for more relevant data, empirical work that will link the unpaid economy to national economies. Lastly, I want to give an interesting insight about the vulnerability issue that women, whether they are in highly developed economies where formal sector jobs are, you know, easy for them, where there are labor standards and so on, they still have some kinds of vulnerability that are linked simply to the fact that they are women, and that within the home, away from the public space, gender power relations still, you know, work against women. There is a study from Sweden that I was discussing with somebody recently, that it was a medical study monitoring the blood pressure of women and men in the same, you know, employment spaces, you know, same level of skills and so on, monitoring their blood pressure from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's at the end of their work. And the study found out that for women, for men, the blood pressure, you know, rises gradually until about 2, and then begins to drop, you know, to the end of the day. But for women, the blood pressure actually levels, you know, lowers from 8, and then by 2, it begins to rise, and continues to rise to the end of the day, meaning that even in Sweden, where gender equality indices are very, very impressive, we still have this vulnerability. You mentioned vulnerability, you know, that is not linked to income. So that is why I pointed this out, that gender power relations are still operating within the home. You know, in marriages, even when women appear to be otherwise income secure. So that this is just an empirical observation. Thank you.
I have such situation. In Uzbekistan, where I come from, it's also former Soviet Republic. In education and healthcare sector, almost 85% are women. And it is considered as formal sector, and with all the benefits, pension schemes, and all these things. But recently, we have these discussions going on about that discrimination against women, that they are working in this in these two sectors. They are mainly heavily employed in these two sectors because the wages in these sectors are relatively low than the private sector and other industrial sectors. So people are arguing that women are discriminated, but in your presentation, I saw that as people have more like regular wage jobs, they are less prone to poverty. That in the pyramid.
That's for the informal sector.
That's
in the informal. I mean, it's.
It's not for the formal one.
That the triangle, just to clarify, triangle is for the informal. It's like looking at the hierarchy of jobs in the informal economy, that you could see also wide differences between both the nature as well as the earnings of this informal sector employments. Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
But go ahead.
What these arguments about promoting women's switch to private sector, to these industrial sectors, how do you think they are justified? Like, because in the private sector, there is high volatility, as you mentioned. The people are, today they are employed, tomorrow they are not employed. And mostly they are men, the men are employed in those sectors. But due to several, reasons of the transition, the private sector is so volatile, and men usually migrate to other more wealthier countries to earn their money, their income. So, how would it be worth to promoting women to switch to private those sectors, like when they have those secure benefits, pensions, schemes, and secure wages? And I would like to know your opinion about that.
Thank you. It was very interesting presentation. I have a few remarks with regard to the informal sector, because really in our economies, I would say that the informal sector is 80% of the economy.
And where are you from, Taco?
I'm from Senegal.
Senegal, yes.
And it's not just unemployed people who get engaged in the informal sector, but it is also a way of supplementing the salary of the working poor.
Yeah.
So people might have a good, decent job in office, but they have a small informal activity on the side.
Yeah, yes.
The second dimension is the level of informality.
Yeah.
Because although the activities might be informal, the states create space where they can collect tax. You would go to any local market, you know, the seller might be doing informal activity, but every day there is somebody who comes and collects a small fee from you so that you can do your activity on that market. So in terms of the taxation...
It's a private tax as opposed to government.
It goes to government.
It really goes
to government. So they find creative ways of taxing also the informal sector. The third issue is, I think it responds to demand.
I'm sorry?
It responds to the demands of the poor, because you go to any small shop in my country, you can buy one cigarette, two pieces of sugar, a small glass of vinegar, and that the poor cannot just afford to buy in bigger quantities. And the other aspect of the responding to demand is, for example, when we were doing some studies on cross-border trade in Africa, you would see that at first the market is not due to exist. But now they put a border checkpoint. People stay in cars in long lines. So some women come and start selling water around there. Others start bringing fruits. You know, there is some prostitution sometimes. And that's how you create some kind of informal markets. And when it gets to a certain stage, then the government tries to make sense of it and put some places where people could sell and so on. So sometimes it responds to unmet demands that the government should have been addressing and that it is not. In my country, again, we had the linkage with trade. We have many Chinese who have come, opened the small shops, and it is very easy to get involved. You just come with an ID, They give you the goods. You don't have to bring any money to start with. They just take a photocopy of your ID, give you the goods. You go, you sell, you come back, and you pay their money and you keep your benefit. Mm-hmm. And there are ways where people who have been looking at it found that it had a good impact on crime. Mm-hmm. Because then it was like crime decreased, because even those who didn't have anything to engage with could just go there and get some goods to sell on the streets. Mm-hmm. So there is really a clear link with the way it has expanded in all of West Africa. Now, I agree that some part of the informal sector need to be more regulated. And I'm talking, for example, about domestic workers, because you have a lot of violence against domestic workers or unfair treatment in our countries. So there are particular aspects that are very key to women engaged in that sector that we need to look at in terms of social protection and so on. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. And I have several remarks. Well, first of all, when you talk about the poor who are working in the United States, I remember a program I was watching a few months ago about women from Latin America who sells food in the cars, and how usually the policeman or someone will come and take these cards from them, and they will lose everything. Mm-hmm. And I remember how they were talking about that this is the only way to support their families, and they came here to work to support the family back home. And I always wonder why governments, instead of regulating these people and give them the protection, because as well they will be like exposed to harassment, sometimes raping and violence of men walking in the streets. Mm-hmm. So, and policemen as well, because they are... Yeah, exactly. So, and this doesn't only happen in the United States, even in my country, mm-hmm. because where there is checkpoints, there is a lot of cars, a lot of people waiting to cross these checkpoints to mm-hmm. where they want to go. And usually you will find a lot of children mm-hmm. selling there. Mm-hmm. Like they will clean your car, and then they will tell you, give me as much as you want. Or they will tell you, please buy from me. And usually I talk to them. I tell him why you don't go to your school and why you don't study instead of selling, why your father sent you to sell. And he will tell me, no, I go to school, I study, but then I work afterwards. Mm-hmm. And this is just like to support my family. And if you buy from me, I promise this is the last time I will come, but then next day I will see you. But what we don't realize is that now, with the more of the informalization of work, mm-hmm. and the more that we encourage such informalization of work, is that we deal with people now as a commodities and not as a human being. Mm-hmm. And this, the more we accept it, the more the unions are weaker, the mm-hmm. more workers' rights are exploited, and the more we can't really negotiate as a unit and gain more rights. But actually, we are losing the rights that once in the past others fought it, so we gain them and we get them. And usually, and mostly women, like before, the women in the, for example, the nurse in the UK, they fought so they get their rights. But now we see that these rights are taken back again from them, one by one, claiming that this is best for their works and this is creating more job opportunities because of the flexibilization of work. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your presentation the ILO labor standards. But what we don't know is these labor standards, there is no way to enforce them. Even if the country ratify these standards, there is no way to enforce it, because usually, even if you read them, they will just say that the country may do it, and it's very, very soft laws, and more than just enforcement for others, for the countries and for the MNCs to employ it, to like implement it and give the workers their rights. For example, in Israel, every day they actually exploit workers, and every day there is violations for workers' rights and for human rights as well. For Palestinians,
workers and as well for migrant workers, because now they want to stop taking Palestinians as workers. So they're bringing workers from China, Philippines, Indonesia, and they are migrants who are working with no workers' rights, not even the ILO workers' rights. They don't really get well paid. There is no insurance for them. There is no any kind of protection for them. So I these are like where my notes are on your representation and everything you said.
First of all, I really appreciate your comments and your response. I mean, my presentation is meant to really sort of provoke this kind of discussion and discourse. So I appreciate them very much. I may not be able to answer all of them. I took down notes. But let me just say a couple of things in a broad sense, and then I will answer very specific questions. One thing I forgot to mention in my discussion on the informal sector, because a lot of the questions is on that topic, is that the informal economy, its linkage with the formal sector is very crucial. The character of the formal economy influences but not solely determines the character of the informal economy. I think many of the comments you have raised point to that point. And that's why it's important to examine more carefully in terms of the research that I mentioned for people to do, what are these linkages? What are the dynamic relationship? One example, for example, yes, you pointed out, is that if you have a very bureaucratic sort of economy with very high transaction costs, you said, you're going to have the informal economy. Of course, it's not regulated. You just create a job. And if you see there's a need, you're quite innovative. Well, I'm going to be a space holder. So that's one part. Another aspect of the character of the formal economy affecting the informal economy is the type of distribution, income distribution in the modern, in the formal. If you have very unequal distribution of income, you're going to see the proliferation of informal sector jobs that cater to a very the large low income classes. My work has been on the urban squatter areas. I mean, some of you have seen the slum dog millionaire. Well, that was in India, so you can sort of see some sort of parts of. I mean, see that in countries like Bolivia, Philippines, Ecuador, Thailand. Income inequality shapes very much the character, in my view, of the informal sector. Having to sell one cigarette as opposed to buying a cigarette pack tells you the level of incomes of people in that country. If you cannot buy a cigarette pack, that means that tells you already that there are many people whose basic needs or even few luxuries like cigarettes have to be met at very, sort of incremental, small-scale level. And it actually increases, if you think about it, what you call intermediation costs. You buy it from a cigarette company, then you buy it from a wholesaler, then you buy it from a retailer, then you buy it from another retailer, and then you sell it in the street on a piece rate. I mean, at the end of the day, you could see. Now, from a macro perspective, an efficiency issue and productivity issue, is this the kind of jobs that we want? Okay, sort of what you call intermediation type of jobs. That's something that we. But what I observe, for example, in the squatter areas where I've done some work, is that you have a proliferation of informal sector jobs that cater to the needs of the people in the slums, not necessarily connected to the global chain. Some are, some aren't. So that's one aspect that I think. So the character, if you have a very modern formal economy, so for example, certain parts of India, like Bangalore kind of thing, where you have subcontracting kind of thing of skilled labor, kind of jobs that are outsourced from the U.S. and so forth, you have a very different type of informal, that's not informal, I'm sorry. Let me clarify that. But there may be still some small scale kind of jobs at the bottom of the outsourcing, that, for example, that may have some sort of a dynamic kind of character. And some of these informal businesses eventually become formal sector, formal jobs. They get licensed and so forth. So I think there's need to look into some of this aspect. But I see that the issue of distribution is so critical in understanding the character of the informal economy. Whether you have a lot of very dynamic jobs that are productive, that both also support economic needs and welfare of the household and the workers and their households, or whether they are very precarious, hand-to-mouth kind of existence, that's something we need to examine. Why is it certain, types of informal economy tend to have this proliferation of precarious jobs? And why is it that certain informal economies tend to have a much more dynamic? Certainly there are precarious, but they also have a lot more dynamic aspect. I think we need to understand more. I'm not saying that I understood all the issues at this point. Now, somebody raised, it's not for me to say that we should get rid of the informal sector economy or not. What I am trying to argue here is that we need to understand it better. We need to understand it at many dimensions because it's more complex than what we think it is. It's more nuanced than what we think it is. And for example, I'm going to be jumping in terms of answering the questions you have and response to the comments you've made. For example, the financial crisis. We don't have data right now on the current financial crisis. I hope they're collecting. I think they're in the process probably of collecting data now, and there may be some that are coming out, maybe in a few months from now or a year from now. But just to mention, for example, the East Asian financial crisis, we don't really have very solid evidence, to show that the informal sector. Yes, we know that the informal sector, for example, in the East Asian crisis, in many parts of the Philippines, and Thailand, have grown, but there are many sources or factors that influence the growth of the informal economy. What aspect of it is due primarily to the financial crisis, and what is due to the kind of trends that's been continuing even before the financial crisis is something that we need to unravel. I don't think there has been really, conscious or strong effort to analyze what happened in the informal economy. There was a lot of discussion, for example, on what happened to poverty. Of course, it has increased in many of those countries that have been affected by the financial crisis. But for the large part, much of the discussion, whether it be on finance, credit, or even in the formal labor markets, much of it has focused where there is data, and that is a lot of it is in the formal labor markets, because that's better documented than those in the informal sector. But though we do know what happened, for example, in households in rural areas and so forth, agricultural households that may engage in informal as well as farm activities, but for the most part, didn't give us a complete picture of what really happened in the informal economy. The issue of labor flexibility, I want to present it here, and maybe I didn't do a sort of a good job at the in my presentation, that labor flexibility is a double-edged sword. It's not so much that it's bad or it's good. Okay, what I'm trying to say is that it has a dual and contradictory character. We don't argue that it's all good, and we don't argue that it's all bad. But we need to understand what are the aspects of labor flexibility that makes workers, certain groups of workers, particularly women workers, more vulnerable or more subject to weakened bargaining in asking for, say, their piece rate. If you're being paid, somebody said, she can't find a job. She's bound at her home to have, because she has 4 children. Well, I can pay her as low as I can, and I can pay as high as I can. Going back to the point about efficiency, of course, these are corporations. These are profit-maximizing for corporations. And as we know, profit maximization is the flip side of cost minimization, right? If you can lower the cost, why not? Okay? The point I'm making is, it goes back to one comment, is that we have to look at workers not just as an input in the economic growth, but it is really the well-being of people, including workers, that we are talking about. And that's the objective of development and growth. Sometimes we forget that. We look at labor as a resource, an input, no different than capital. And there's a very big difference between capital and labor, because labor also embodies the objective of development, and that's the well-being. So do we separate them, or do we address them together when we think about policies? And I think that's very important, that we don't lose sight of why we are doing what we are doing. I think we, given all the recent trends that's, in terms of financial crisis, I think there's now also a sort of, even within the economics profession, to look beyond just the notion of income or earnings as an indicator of well-being. We need to look beyond that, and that goes to why we just, I think it was pointed out earlier, that we need to talk about rights, because workers are also the objective of growth and development, their well-being. So if we separate that, then we can certainly ignore this issue of workers' rights. Now, whether imposing labor standards, both formal and informal workers, is the most effective way to go is subject to discussion, to thinking, because obviously the issue of implementation is very important. We're talking about many countries which has weak governance structures in the first place, which is also very bureaucratic, okay, which has subject to graft and corruption and so forth. So where does this start? For me, at least in the work I've done, and even in the studies, very small samples that we've had, even in the urban slums, big difference among slums. Slums are not the same. There are slums which are organized, which has a people action council, which limits the number of gangs and crimes in their neighborhood. And there are slums where you have crimes and gangs and violence prevailing, not just on women, but also on men. Okay, and a large part differentiation between these two types of slums and squatters is the role of community organizations and social and collective action. That is so critical, whether it be grassroots organizations or a broader organizations like, for example, SEWA, Self-Employed Women's Employment in Association in India, or HomeNet, that makes a difference. Okay, let me just see whether I have answered all of them. One other point, in terms of employment, at the end of the day, whose responsibility is it to get a job? My thinking and my view, and of course this is not viewed shared by all economists, certainly especially among labor economists, is that there is an important role of the state, because the right to work is part of the Declaration of Human Rights that all countries have agreed to. There are economic rights in that Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Human rights include economic rights, including right to work. But in recent decades, okay, that right, that social contract, that contract between government and its citizenry has been eroded. Whose responsibility is to get a job? Your responsibility. It has gone to the realm of the private. sector. Just like the issue of childcare, raising children has now pushed to the realm of the private sector. You hire a maid or you find a daycare center, it's not my problem. Firms are not engaged in dealing with childcare facilities, that's going to be added cost. There's this kind of mentality. So I think it's important to think, what's the right of the individual in terms of employment, creation, or jobs, and the right of the and the responsibility of the of the government. My thinking is that there's an important role of the government, the responsibility of the state in employment creation and in promoting decent work. Thank you.
I've been listening to the discussion on informal versus formal, and I was trying to identify what my discomfort, for want of a better word, was with the conceptualization of the informal economy as something that is opposite to and less than or not as good as the formal economy. And I think that is why I'm uncomfortable with it. It is set up as an extension of binaries that we've been trying to deconstruct in heterodox economies, mm-hmm. heterodox economics, and in feminist theories in general, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we need to reconceptualize and deconstruct this hierarchy of knowledge in terms of how we are perceiving or how we are looking at the informal economy as something that is informal. It is quite possible that those who are working in the informal economy do not consider what they are doing informal. I mean, I've written some of it down, so I'm just going to say what I've written down. That their agency to survive, create, innovate is more deserving than the label informal. Mm-hmm. That what they do has a structure to it, those who operate in the informal economy also have structures to it, mm-hmm. right? So I think we also have an epistemological bias which affects how we understand and measure the informal economy. Mm-hmm. And I think this comes out of this a tradition of setting up binaries. Mm-hmm. And we can even call it a Western tradition of setting up binaries in terms of how we examine society. Mm-hmm. How can we alter this examination in a more heterodox way rather than a linear way? Mm-hmm. There's an approach to understanding society that Kamau Brathwaite, a cultural historian a cultural historian and writer coming out of Barbados, and his concept of what he calls tidalectics rather than dialectics. Mm-hmm. And tidalectics, he took the word tidalectics because of the constant movement and unpredictability of the waves of a typical sea.
Yeah.
Typical, you know, beach in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And he used the term to say that we have to be able to examine contradictions and change as norm rather than as abnormal too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I believe that this is one area, our examination of the informal economy is one area where we have to really change the lens that we use, mm-hmm. right? And so I don't think we should call it informal economy. If we used to call it something, we now have this thing called the care economy, we need to find a new label for this other economy. I don't know what we want to call it.
Yeah, mine is very... very short, and it is about the formal economy. A lot has been talked about the informal. One of the recommendations of the structure of adjustment programs was that governments had to reduce their public service. The number of employees in the public sector had to be reduced. And of course, the idea behind this was they wanted to make public service maybe more efficient and more productive. Now, two things I wanted to know from you are, of course, like in Uganda, so many people are laid off, but trust the Ugandan, people shifted jobs. And they went to work in other in the same government structure, but in other departments. So there was a lot of task shifting. Now, if I shifted a job, shifted a job from one place to another, from one place where I'm more qualified to another place where I'm maybe less qualified, am I still regarded as skilled manpower? But the most important thing I wanted to know was, have there been any studies maybe carried out to establish the impact of the so-called small, efficient public sector, or public or private sector, on productivity and then saving and reinvestment? Is there any study which has been carried out? Two is Uganda is trying to implement a social protection framework to address the concerns of the vulnerable groups, of course, including the working poor. And of course, the framework has four areas. One is social assistance, of course, to assist all those that maybe have lost jobs and they cannot earn any income for a living. The other area is the social services, to try and subsidize, of course, the costs for the working poor, like education, health, and so on. The third area is social equity, to try and balance between the women and the men. But of course, for the working class, we have what we call social insurance. They kind of come up with saving schemes. Of course, these schemes have a lot of money. Now, the issue is you cannot access this money until you are a certain age. What is your take on this?
Can you repeat the last question? Sorry.
Now, they have created like saving schemes for the working groups. But the problem with this saving schemes is that you cannot access the money until you are a certain age, 55 and above. Now, is this a good scheme for the working persons? And then finally, how do you institute or enforce the workers' rights in an environment where there is excess kind of labor? Because I may want my rights protected, but then another person who is unemployed is saying, no, give me the job. I wouldn't mind about the rights. Thanks.
Hello? Okay. Well, just I would like to thank you for your presentation. That opened my mind to share with you some of my experience with lots of projects I manage in the delegation of the European Union in Peru. I travel, as I told you several times, I travel a lot around Peru to the jungle, mountains, area around the country. So I saw a lot of necessity and a lack of training, especially in rural women. In rural sectors in Peru, the woman don't finish the school because the priority of for the fathers is to give education to the boys. So in that point is a relation between education and training. No? Lately I finished a project. This project was presented by the feminist NGO in Peru. And they wanted to improve the social security in a small enterprise of women. Mm-hmm. But what happened, the project was going good, but at the end, the government changed the normativity, the laws, no? Mm-hmm. They wanted to improve the social security, as I told, but was very difficult to improve the social security in Peru because it has a high cost for the small enterprise. It implies a cost, no? What more? Other thing is that the liberalization of the economy in Peru also, in fact, the government was trying to attract investments, so they reduce the quality of the normativity, no? Of the quality of jobs in Peru. Well, I think the conclusion is that there is a huge lack of necessity to training, no? If we want to improve the quality of job. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sergi, I have two comments. One is this question that relating more explicitly the problem of the trade regime, right, with the question of social protection and workers' rights in the developing countries. Mm-hmm. I think there are many cases in which, for example, in Lesotho, workers are actually imported because there is a free trade agreement with the United States, and this is true with Jordan and a lot of other countries. They actually, because there are no workers, but there is money to be made by serving the free trade agreement. They import the workers from elsewhere, and that's because of the rules of origin that the trade agreement requires. That's the first comment I had. The other one is this question about social sector and providing social protections for workers and healthcare. I mean, it's really just a general comment that I guess the first question that anybody would ask is, where will you get the money, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, to the extent that you're then going to have to sacrifice your international competitiveness if you're going to be serious about it. Mm-hmm. But the other comment I had is, in many cases, targeted social protection is even more expensive than mm-hmm. universal social protection. Okay, and in effect, it was the Soviet-style economies that actually managed this informal sector in a very good way, because they just provided universal protection. In many cases, insisting on targeting the social protection like healthcare and childcare and all that stuff is actually more costly than providing it for everybody just like that. And then you will have a more competitive economy internationally. Anyway, this is just, this is something that maybe people can look at to the extent that how certain economies are coping with this kind of social provisions, right, in a more competitive way. Mm-hmm.
Want to respond to questions and comments?
Okay. Yes. I think we need to give time for the other speakers also. So I'm going to just answer it very briefly. Yes, I think the points that I raised are important. I think we need to look at it in a very, what is the term? She didn't use the word dialectic. She used title. Lectic, okay. I think that's certainly an interesting and viewpoint that needs and perspective that is worth exploring further and making you understand the character of the informal economy. Now, I know that I have used the term informal sector and informal economy here in a very loose way. It may not give the very sort of exact definition. We'll leave it to the next speaker to discuss it from the ILO definition. But there is sort of, first of all, it is unorganized in a legalistic sense. Some people use the legalistic definition, which is that you're not registered. Okay, whether a person or an entrepreneur, let's focus on an entrepreneur rather than informal sector work. Whether an entrepreneur or a business person or an own account worker prefers to work informally or formally, having the enterprise, will be determined by what are the advantages Even if you have to pay taxes and registered, what are your advantages to being a licensed thing? Could have a wider distribution, wider marketing, more access to other customers, some benefits from the government in terms of some form. So I think there are issues. And not that I'm saying that all formal businesses, sector businesses are bad and all informal good and all informal sector businesses and enterprises are inferior. I think we cannot anymore have that kind of sort of linear, as she would use it, sort of dichotomy. I think that's precisely the point. You have an informal sector that is more nuanced. But also the formal sector we know is very varied too and heterogeneous. I didn't want to spend time talking about that. There are companies that have voluntary codes of conducts and impose on themselves some labor codes. And there are some firms that just violate and have what you call sweatshops. So, you know, and so forth. So even in the formal economy, you have a very varied, you have it also heterogeneous type. So I would not want to. The one thing, though, from a worker's perspective, I'm thinking it from the person who's, you know, working. From a worker's perspective, what are the, certainly there are things that you could do creatively, innovatively in the informal economy that you may feel constrained doing it in the formal sector. And again, that's where, you know, business conditions and business environment and other factors come into play. However, there are also creative, innovative entrepreneurs in the formal sector. It's not all happening in the informal economy. We have some of the sort of recent development in technology, information technology, happening in the formal sector and even also at the small scale level. We know the growth of, you know, certain companies that started small and have become large, Mrs. Field cookies and all that, they have grown into large, and the same thing in developing countries. So it's not necessarily that you're all, you know, the creativity and innovation is restrained in the formal economy as in the formal. I think we need to look into it. That's my suggestion. Then let me see. I want to answer and I want to also answer about the position or conditions faced by women and men in the formal economy, formal markets, like I forgot to address your question, as well as in the informal. There are, true, men are also can be hurt, okay, as mentioned in the Uzbekistan. You know, you have also men may have irregular jobs as compared to women, but may have more stable jobs. You have, depends on the sector, depends on the level of skills, depends on the character of growth of that sector. I think, you know, those are certain things that you need to take into account. But in general, I'm just saying, we're not on a sector level, but in a general level, at least there's been evidence to show that men tend to have regular, stable jobs with access to benefits. We're talking about health benefits, pensions, and so forth. And women tend to have jobs, even in the formal sector, because they are part-time, they're casual, they're temporary, they go in and out, they have very high turnover rates. They neither get promoted, they don't move up, their earnings tend to be lower, and they tend to concentrate in certain types of jobs, as you have mentioned. So I think if you compare them to construction workers, yes, they're probably better off and more stable. But you compare them with employees and managers in other sectors, or even in the same sectors, may be different. So it depends on your point of comparison, too. The other thing, I think Butch raised an important question. Where do you get resources for social protection? And that's why I think it's important to look at social policies as a sort of very much related to the issue of distribution. How much do you want to redistribute income? What kind of fiscal stimulus package? We're talking here in the U.S. now. Where are you going to get the money? Are you going to continue in borrowing? Or you can raise taxes. But, of course, there are political issues and, you know, politics involved and all that. So the issue of resources is fundamental in thinking about this. I have one example of a sort of universal low-cost health insurance coverage is what I observed in Thailand.
In 1999, after the East Asian crisis, this is different from the Philippines, for example. In Thailand, they issued what you call a health insurance card, a voluntary. Now, it's you have very basic fundamental, it's basic healthcare services. If you're ill, you get to see a doctor for 30 baht or 40 baht. I think it's 45 or 50 baht now. But that we saw in the urban squatter area. So people also in the informal sector have access to that universal. Anybody in the metropolitan, anybody has access to that universal basic health care. And that is given. Now, of course, you can't get the hospital with that, but at least certain illnesses are addressed. I think we have to be creative in what types, and this is where I see the importance also of being very effective and very efficient. How do we use scarce resources, financial resources, to be able to provide social protection to the broad people? And I agree, targeting tends to be very problematic. It adds a lot of costs in terms of implementation, monitoring, and accounting. If we see that the right to health and health is important, then it should be universally covered. Now, what types of health care benefits you give on a universal level depends, of course, on your resources. The issue of pensions, you were mentioning about, I think what you're talking about is pensions, your savings, for savings, terms for retirement after age 65. Given the increasing life expectancy of women and men, both in the developing countries as well as in the developed world, in the last 40 years, okay, in the last 50 years, when you retire, what is your source of earnings? So the idea behind this is that you are also vulnerable when you're elderly. Now, of course, this retirement savings enables you to have some source of earnings, okay, even when you a source of income when you don't have any more a job. That's it. Thank you.